listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page. Martin.
Dancing in heaven, I never thought I'd ever get my feet this far.
Obed Obebop.
There we are. Start of a great show.
That is going to be a good show.
That's a little late on that.
Nice to be here, Mike. Thank you.
I'm staring at
this. Is this my turn to sing now at this point?
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Dancing!
No.
Hi. English accent, actually.
Hello. Next to him, we've got Bobby Osinski. Bobby.
You don't want to hear me sing. Hey, Mike. Hey, guys.
And finally, over here on my left, we've got the one and only Rob Arbitier.
Who will also not be singing this evening.
And today, we have with us, as our guests, the one and only Brian Fairweather.
Yay! Thank God there's only one and only. Really nice to see you again, Mike. And all this time.
As you could hear from Martin's hello, Brian was in Q-Field, which was the band that kind of brought both Martin and Brian over to America, and had the...
Like a plague. It was like a plague, yes.
And had their big hit, Dancing in Heaven. And we're going to be talking about 80s. We're going to be talking about all things 80s on this podcast. Not only are we going to talk about the music and how it influences music even today, but we're also going to be talking about technology and how technology of the 80s actually influences a lot of stuff that we do today. So, Brian, it's great to have you with us.
Before we do that,
there's a few things I want to get to. Number one, guys, this is our first podcast on the brand new Audio Nowcast Pro Tool system. It's mobile, for one, so we can take this and do some fun things.
And it's built-in echo.
We still got to work out a couple of latency issues, but basically we took the gigantic $20,000 Pro Tools HD3 system and reduced it to a single rack space.
Wow. Impressive.
Which was... You know, just the way technology goes.
See, next week we have to do it on the iPad.
Hey, that's probably not too far away. But
and it's really nice to see our engineer is out here with
that's
us.
That's right.
Teamwork. See, now we know there actually is one.
Yes.
But it was kind of good and bad. It's literally I got rid of a lot of my old gear and picked up the Focusrite interface, the Sapphire 20. And it's just amazing that all the cost and expense that went into buying the big Pro Tool system.
Didn't you buy that in the 80s?
No.
But, I'm trying to segue into the
80s. I thought, you know.
Weren't you wearing that shirt in the 80s?
That was true. But it was really interesting to see how technology really has improved. And once you start upgrading, you realize that some of these upgrades aren't going to cost as much. They're going to be way more powerful. And in the long run, just give you a lot more flexibility. And for us, it's the ability to record our podcasts out on the road now. You know, so next week, Denny's. All right? Just want to let you know. And along that line, I wanted to bring this up. You know, West LA Music basically just closed its doors.
Which is in L.A.
Right, which was in West L.A.
West L.A.
and was bought by Guitar Center. And I just wanted to, you know... I don't know how I feel about that. I felt actually when I heard the news, I found a tremendous sense of loss because of the history of West LA Music, especially if you're doing any road work back in the 90s. If you wanted to, you know, outfit your tour, there was Goodman's Music, there was Guitar Center, and there was West LA. And you basically would work between the three of them and sometimes have them all, you know, fight against each other. But that's where you would get your stuff. And there's a lot of history in West LA Music. A lot of – you always would see, you know, pictures of who was buying gear there. I know Stevie bought a ton of gear from West LA. And I don't know. I wanted to open it up to you guys really quick about, you know, if you think it's just – well, that's just the cost of doing business, or did we lose a little something? Is it like losing, you know, some of the studios, or how, what's your perspective on this, Rob?
I had mixed feelings. I mean,
for history reasons, it was sad to see it go because we'd been shopping there for a long time,
right.
You know, along with all the other stores you mentioned. But, you know, as far as buying gear, it sounds a little weird to say, we don't buy nearly as many keyboards and musical instruments as we used to.
Right.
There doesn't seem to be as much innovation as there used to be, and so much of what we do now is virtual instruments that you can basically buy online. So it's not like the days where we used to go into the music store every week and just go through racks and racks of keyboards and try the stuff out and then buy a bunch of stuff.
That's
true. Those years are gone. Of course, now we have racks and racks of keyboards, so we wouldn't be needing any new ones unless there was something truly innovative. And, you know, there are a small handful of new keyboards each year that are interesting now, but it's not like in the old days when there was real innovation. And a place like West LA was where you'd go to hear all that stuff.
That's true. You couldn't download a demo of a Juno 106. You know what I mean? But now you can download demos of any soft synth that's out there. So mm-hmm. I guess in that respect,
I find it sad, though, because I think that the more companies that are out there that are promoting music and live playing can only be a good thing. I was over at Guitar Center buying something and with a friend there who works in the shop, and he said, yeah, we've just got all their stuff and everything. And I said, how do you feel about this? He said, well, the top guys are very happy because they said that everybody's going to come here. You know, the same way when Borders and all the bookshops shut down, it's like you look at Book Soup and Amoeba must have been when Tower Records went out, you know.
Right.
But even he said, in a way, it sort of stops. If one dies, it can also affect the vibe on the whole thing, you know.
Yes, yeah, because not everybody who went to West LA shows up at Guitar Center. A lot of them, the reason stores go under is because the business is down.
Yeah. It's a sign.
But I see the music store industry broken the two pieces. And I think that there's the pieces that cater to the high school and the newbies and the young musicians that are mass selling, you know, the $100 Squire guitars and the inexpensive. So once you try to go for that kind of profit margin and that kind of expanse, well, then all of a sudden you're competing against Sweetwater and Guitar Center. Because at that point, there's no quality. You just get in a new yada yada. You go online, you find out what it is, and you order it like you do at Best Buy. Everybody goes to Best Buy, figures out what they want, goes back home, and orders it online,
right,
which is a big problem Best Buy is having. But on the flip side, I think out of this is coming boutique music stores. All of a sudden, you've got Vintage King.
Yeah, that's
true. You've got the place over in Santa Monica that I'm spacing out. That the guitar store.
True Tone. Amp Shop on
Aventura. Amp Shop. Yeah. So now what's happening is instead of these big mega stores that are happening, now there's these mom and pop little – because you can't, on the high end, when you start spending $1,000 or even $500 on a guitar, you can't do it online.
Yeah.
Because every guitar sounds a little bit different. So you got to go to these boutique places. So I think that if you're going to get an instrument that has character,
right,
where each instrument's a little bit different than the other, the boutique instruments stores will pick up that need. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, if you want the latest Kontakt or software or something, it doesn't matter where you buy
it. That's true.
It's a box that comes in the mail, and at that point, you're going to start seeing in national-based companies, aka Guitar Center, Sweetwater. And that's kind of the new paradigm.
Well, you know, Sweetwater, their customer service is pretty fantastic. Yeah. I've always had – when I've bought stuff through them, I've always had some really, really knowledgeable guys on the other side of the phone. And they just, you know, serviced very well. Everything was taken care of and, you know, everything got delivered when they said it was delivered. And I think you're right, Scott. I think there's going to be room, but it's going to be a little bit different. There's going to be this little boutique thing that's going to be going on.
There's something special about players walking into a room, picking up an instrument and jamming and playing in there and watching other people play, you know, and seeing people take a guitar down off the wall. It's romantic. It gets the spirit going.
And it is very different between guitar and keyboards, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because the keyboard stuff, I mean, unless you're buying grand pianos or, you know, handmade instruments, where there is a real difference between them. Most keyboards are cookie cutter, you know, mass production things now. But guitars, the good ones never will be.
But even Guitar Center, I live up in a small town up in northern LA, and they opened up a Guitar Center a couple blocks away from me. And I thought, wow. And there were a whole bunch of stores that were empty. And I thought, you know, Linens and Things or something, one of the big mega stores, they'll move in there. Mm. No, they moved into a really place that used to be a boutique clothing store. And I was figuring, how are they going to fit the store there? They did an amazing job, actually, the person who figured out the layout should win an award because everything is there. Keyboards, drums, recording, DJ, and they have lessons. They have small, they have 10 rooms in the back. They do private lessons. What Guitar Center seems to be rebuilding themselves is as the mom and pop shop.
Yeah.
They're really rather having the big stores because right now to be able to hold a lot of inventory and have that liability
doesn't
make sense.
You know, they're recognizing what you say, and that is that you know, there is a value to the smaller store, the more personal kind of service. I mean, I'm personally, being a guitarist, I'm thrilled. Guitar Center took it over. I can't tell you the number of Saturdays I spent like on Guitar Center, like picking off that, you know, that guitar off the wall you were talking about, and playing for myself and everybody else. I happened to be bored enough to listen to me, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, you guys obviously have a keyboard kind of orientation towards it. Well, minus more guitar.
Yeah, know? I think mainly just the history for me, but there's definitely a validity of the new paradigm, and like Rob was saying. Back in the day, you know, back in the 80s, you know, I owe my career to Guitar Center and Goodsman Music because that's the only way I could get my hands on some of these keyboards.
But see, that's where Goodman's. I remember when I first moved into Goodman's. LA, they had like Fairlights and all these synths that were $100,000, $200,000, and you were like, they were the only ones that had it, and you can actually play.
You could actually play them. Yeah.
Chromas and
Bobby, what do you think of the whole situation?
Well, to me, any retail store that goes out of business is a sad event.
Yeah.
But it's inevitable because what ends up happening is the retail store is the showroom for Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or
for
Sweetwater, unfortunately. By the way, what you're talking about, what opened near you was called, in the industry, Guitar Center Lite. And the way they work is they'll say, we can get you anything you want tomorrow. If you come in here and you know, if we don't have it tomorrow, you'll have it. Which is very powerful because, you know, now they can open up all these small satellite stores wherever and make it work. But the real problem here, I think, is the fact that there's so much power in one retailer. So much market share in Guitar Center. And they're using it in such a way that it's not helpful to the industry. And they're trying to make money, so I understand. By the way, Bain Capital, does that ring a bell? Bain owes them.
This is
Mitt Romney's Bain, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the problem is they dictate to manufacturers what the price should be. So in other words, whatever the price is that they're selling, they'll go to the manufacturer and they'll say, no, we want to pay 10% lower than that.
Walmart.
Very much like that. Very Walmart. Much.
What Bobby's saying, and just to interrupt briefly, Bobby, is that I was speaking to the guy at Guitar Center who was helping me, and he said since they came in, you know, they had a great relationship with all the pros. So the pros would come in and say, you know, do me a better deal and I'll sign, get the extra tax off. He said, this company said none of that anymore. What it is, and keep the prices up. And I thought that was a great shame for the relationships for the people that have really been there for years and will always see it as a place to be treated a little more special because they've been there for a long time.
Well, that's a sign of the times. I mean, I think, you know, to get that personal service these days is really rare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's amazing that there is a store, a music store, that you can walk into these days because I've seen so many businesses, not just in music, but in cameras and whatever. They just go out of business because it's all internet now. You do your shopping on the internet. You want to see the real thing. You go into the store, have a mess around with the real thing, and then you go and buy on the internet.
Right. Yeah. You know? Cheaper. Yeah.
It's cheaper.
Yeah. But I do think that also, I'm a guitar player.
Yep.
So I appreciate it. Brother. Is that I still think that, like, I remember when Everything Audio in that used to be in LA, they were the pro audio company. Mm. I think then music took over that role of pro audio.
I work for Everything Audio.
Wow. Mm. So then what happens, I think, is that right now there is that need. Some people, especially the pros and the people that are professional, they don't want to deal with someone who just came who's in 19, 18, 21, if they're lucky, who really doesn't know the business, they need somebody to take care of them. And they've right. got the money. And while they want, so if you have a, if you hold your expenses down, they'll get you whatever you want. Right. And I think that they are – and they're also relationship-driven because they're business-based.
Right.
So I think that it opens up the doors for boutique companies. And I think that – like again, True Tone is expanded into the
store. They have to keep the prices high to stay open. That's the whole thing. You yeah. can't give a lot, big discounts and stay open if you're going to give service. Yeah. And that's the big problem.
Well, that's the difference between MI and Pro Audio.
Yeah. Now, what's really behind the scenes with West LA Music was the fact that Don owned the building.
Yeah.
And what happened was he couldn't compete with Guitar Center. He was having a really tough time actually making any money. And Chase came in and basically – I'm not sure if they bought it or if they gave him a long-term lease. But he was making more money off the lease or off the sale than he would keeping the store open.
Wow.
So, you know, that's really what happened. And that's a sad day when that happens, when you can't compete with your competitor because they get a better deal than you do. Mm-hmm.
Well, what ends up happening too is when the store, like if the Guitar Center, when they start dictating prices to manufacturers, then you get the Klaus and Pickle effect.
It's even worse though. Now this comes from an exec VP at a very large MI company who shall remain nameless because I'm not sure if this is supposed to be common knowledge, but you'll hear it anyway. Guitar Center actually gives a manufacturer 3 weeks for whatever the new item is to be a hit. If after 3 weeks they don't sell enough, take it all back.
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Wow. And they don't help them sell that. They said, if you want to sell it, you promote it. And Guitar Center won't do it. So that means the shelf life is very, very short on it. Either something hits right away. And, you know, how often does that happen if people don't know about it?
Right.
You know.
It's like the Costco of,
yeah.
of yeah. music
stores. Well, who's going to make hardware with those demands?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Because you got to feed that giant monster of a store.
The investment.
Supplies. And if it doesn't work, you got to eat it all back.
Yeah.
But a lot of what I was noticing, especially on the software side and plugins, they're not even using stores anymore. Mm-hmm. They just say, you know what, buy it online. They keep all the money. It's kind of like selling an album for a buck. You're still going to make probably more money than you would have made sometimes through the record companies because it's all yours. So I think the plug-in companies are saying, hey, I'll sell this for $34, $35, $50. Rather than 200, 300, 400.
Yeah, we're seeing that already.
Well, it's huge.
Yeah. You also, you know, there's also a giant void in just a knowledgeable salesperson because, you know, I remember back in the day when I was on the road, I would deal with the same sales guy. And if I had a problem out in, you know, South Dakota, he would, boom, you know, I need another, you know, MPC 60 or another keyboard or something. He would mm-hmm. pack it up and ship it away and take care of it. And I don't know, just, and he would be knowledgeable too. I'd be able to go in there and say, hey, I need to do this, this, and this. What do you think? And you bounce it back and forth and you get some ideas. And, you know, and this is back when MIDI systems were giant, like with Teddy Riley, and we're running, you know, two giant stacked 32 space racks with, you know, dual Mac systems running at the same time, feeding the keyboard player. And he can start and stop, and I can go in there and get in and out of any part in the song. So if they wanted to on the fly rearrange things, you know, stuff like that, I could not have done on my own. It was really something I had to do with a knowledgeable salesperson to guide me to that direction and give me all the right equipment and all the right techniques too. And I think that's going to be a giant missing link in this whole thing mm-hmm. when they're gone.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Anyway.
I think what Bobby said, though, it's sad to see anything go out of business, which is trying to, you know, make music, but, get out to the masses.
You know, every major city has lost a music store or two that has been there forever. If you look at Boston, it's Daddy's Junkie Music and Wurlitzer's. If you look at New York, it's everything on 48th Street was bought by Sam Ash, and now they're closing down 48th Street and moving it to 38th or 32nd, something like that.
Really? That whole – all those stores are
– gone. Or they're going to be pretty soon.
Oh, that's horrible.
That's horrible.
That is horrible because that was right off of Broadway, and usually if you did a gig, you know,
yeah.
between sound check and the show, I would always go over there and just kind of see
what was famous.
It was the best. I mean, just going into Manny's.
Yeah, you know,
Manny's
exactly.
was the most awesome place, and no one, unless you were there, you can never understand how cool it was.
Mm-hmm. I will say one thing about Manny's. Well, all those stores, they were like, it was like being in a maze, being a mouse in a maze, because they were not very wide. All the aisles were thin, and you had to go in the back, and you always felt like there was going to be something cool right around the corner, and that's a shame. I mean, if you think about even in L.A., that I can think of, like, I wrote down a couple names, like Nadine's.
Nadine's,
right. I mean, come on. That was, you know, that was
– I bought lots of stuff from Nadine's.
That was like the hip music store, and then there was also on the pro side, there was Coast Recording.
Right.
You know, man, you'd go into the Coast Recording.
You'd get all your tape and everything.
Yeah, and you'd see all those old machines and the consoles and stuff like that. I mean, there was just, I don't know. It's.
I bought a lot of cassettes.
It's just, it's well, a shame.
Do you remember buying the cassettes from there?
Do you remember Project One?
Oh, yeah.
Project One.
Yeah.
We used to go crazy with Project One.
It's all the pro audio companies all went out. From Coast to Everything Audio to, and now the music stores now are evolving.
But we should also mention there is still a flicker of what was West LA Music.
Absolutely.
Westlake Pro.
Right, Westlake Pro. And
which used to be West LA East or Cahuenga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then they turned to Westlake Pro, and now they're going to keep going.
But even Westlake itself, when they were off of Santa Monica, you know, they were part of that whole giant.
That's the thing that, you know, being a business owner myself – I mean, we're now 20 years old that I've been running a business. And I think to start a business, you have to be very passionate. You have to be a little crazy because you're going to take everything on, all the responsibility, all the risk. And I think at some point when you go, all right, I don't know if I want to put another second or third on my house and buy the latest yada yadas. And sometimes you go, I just had enough. I've had a run. It was great. It was good. And then the question is, what do you do? You either – somebody maybe in the store wants to buy it or another company, or it just fades away. And then some competitor comes up, and you don't want to do it anymore. So I think that there is a shelf life to businesses.
Yeah.
It's shorter than it used to be, though.
It is. Well, because it's getting tougher. And if you're in your 60s and you don't have that same passion
– same edge. Yeah.
That same edge that you want to – like, come on, let's rumble against a competitor. Mm-hmm. It's just too hard now.
Yeah,
but you know, having said that, all the doom and gloom of everything, you know, going away.
So support your local stores.
Yeah, but you also have things nowadays that I wish we had back then. You know, the internet, online reviews, things of that.
Demo, any kind of software you want.
That cassettes are everything.
You know, I had to call Martin up and say, "What do you do if you're making the demo these days? Do you still put it on a cassette?"
Yeah.
And he's like,
Brian,
you're an idiot.
Well, no, Brian was interested in a Pro Tools setup, weren't you?
Yeah.
So he was sort of thinking about what was a good small system to work on. Yeah.
I mean, it's the good with the bad. I mean, technology. We have Pro Tools now that we can throw in an 8-space rack and take anywhere we want. As a matter of fact, while we're doing this podcast, I just want to let everybody know. You know, this is the first time we're trying it. We had a crash. The computer froze up and
started burning and smoke.
No, but we were all thinking that, you know, that, oh, we lost the whole first half of the show. And the fact that Pro Tools stopped, saved our files, you know, and the computer's still locked up, I mean, that's, you know.
Well, let's go back. Me and Brian were doing the Q-Feel record, and we were told halfway through it that somebody had put their Pepsi Cola on the studio tape machine, and somebody said that it had gone onto the tape, and this was our master. So we had to quickly take that tape down, stop the session, run to another special place in London through traffic, through taxis, and get somebody to wash this tape down and tell us if it could work.
Seriously?
Yeah.
And bring it back. And you know.
I totally forgot about that.
And it was terrifying.
There was no saving that.
That wasn't this, you know, like what we've just gone through. Like, it saved everything. It's like, if this burns through in enough time, you don't have your record. So we have to look back and realize that those tape machines were wonderful, but at the same time, they were like flying Spitfires, weren't they? You know, you didn't know what was going to happen.
Past audio, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're gonna take a break now. And when we come back, we are going to talk about the 80s. We're going to talk a little bit about Q-Field. Right. And we're going to talk about, you know, its influences today in music.
And we should also talk about not inviting people to your session who think of a turning reel of tape as like a spinning coaster to put a coat on.
Yeah.
What's that about?
You know, I think it was the engineer that did that.
Oh, man.
But did he spill it or did he set it on it?
No, you know, we had I can remember it very clearly, actually, that an engineer... Brian and I were drinking Cokes in the studio. It could have been any of us, but it was next to the studio, somewhere near it. And, I think somebody popped it open.
Right.
And I don't think Brian and I were always pissing about in those days and joking, because I think we put a lot of vodka in the Coke as well. An engineer said, I can hear that there's something going on. And we went like, what is it? And then he went to the tape and said, oh, my God. There's fluid on the tape. It is...
sounded like Velcro.
Yeah. I thought it was good distortion, but anyway.
See, that would be a great app. You get UAD, you see the little student effects going. Then someone takes the Coke, puts it on, and then you have to clean it up.
That's right.
This could be software.
Yeah. So why is it soap, you know? Comes
on. So when people talk about what an influence Coke had on the sound of the 80s, is that actually...
They're reading us wrong.
No, I had it totally wrong.
All right, well, we're going to take a break, and we'll see on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, Jeremy was about to lose it. How you doing over there, Jeremy?
This is awesome.
It's like true love, watching that pool of just smooth.
Nothing like trying a new system. And it's good we switched, because we almost had the old one working. This way we can experiment for another 5 years.
That's right.
Sure enough for you.
Didn't we start on a wire recorder?
How many, I was going to say, when we started, they didn't even have Pro Tools on computers yet. Yeah. It was still on tape. So, how long have we been doing this, and what show number is this?
We've been doing this for 6 years, and this is show 123.
Wow. Congratulations.
I just always like reminding us of that, you know, as we're having technical problems.
Yeah. And actually, we've done 125 shows, because we've done a couple specials.
But, was that when the Amiga was the major computer out there then?
Oh, Amiga. Oh, I love that computer.
We're getting nostalgic now.
Which reminds us, when did the Amiga come out?
1980.
80s, yeah.
1980s.
Oh, Scott
was segueing
for you.
Oh, yeah. Is that a segue?
I was trying to help you out.
I was kind of like volleyball, you know, just kind of put it up there and spike it.
You know, every once in a while, a show will come up through a conversation that I will have with somebody or an idea that somebody sends in. And actually, me and Martin were having dinner one night, and we started talking about the 80s. And we started talking about, you know, the music back at the 80s and its influence in music today. And I thought, you know what, this would make a really great show talking about the 80s, because the 80s was a decade that, the fashion was just
you can't talk about the girls.
But it really had a lot of influence on music, not only with just the songwriting and the styles and production, but we were just getting into the technology that was really going to change the way music was being made with the digital and with the synths and with things like that. So anyhow, so once we thought about doing the show, I said, let's do something kind of special. And Martin said, well, I'll ask Brian to come join us.
And I'm glad
and
you
so
did.
Brian...
So nice. The 80s it was a magical time. I mean, it was obviously because we were growing up in the 80s and we were being our most creative in the 80s. It was a very underrated decade. I mean, you had the change from those precious vinyl records to CDs happening. You were gaining a lot. You were losing a lot, depending on your perspective. Martin and I were talking before the show, and we're talking about the diversity of styles. I mean, you had Barbara Streisand, Barry Manilow, you had Spandau Ballet, you had a Haircut 100, you had Q-Feel, of course.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
You had so many things going on, and you had
you had punk still happening.
Right.
I mean, you know, punk started in Britain, right, mid-70s
right.
And peaked, like, late 70s. But in Europe and in the States, it went well into, you know, 2000,
right.
You know? So you had all these mixtures of styles going on that were all accepted and all commercially viable. And it was just such an exciting time. You know?
Let's go back, you know, pre-80s. When you guys got together, you know, tell us a little bit about Q-Field, either one of you, Martin or Brian, and how it got started and what you were trying to do and what were your kind of dreams and goals back in that day?
Other than trying to get laid.
Yeah, which never happened, unfortunately. I'm still crying, mate. I'm still crying.
Now, I think what's interesting and what Brian was saying as well, I came from a funk background. So I'd come through the 70s and I was playing in bands that were emulating the average white band and playing Funkadelic and Parliament and James Brown. We were just playing the clubs. And Brian came from a band from Scotland called Oberon, which was playing very much like prog rock, very much Genesis influence. There's actually a good book out called Electric Eden, which mentions Brian's band, because that was a period when everything was really changing, and Brian and I came together from two different worlds, and we joined a band in London, which enabled us to be friends. I was a bass player. Brian was a guitarist in a band called the Charlie Mullen Band, which was just like a normal, straight-ahead rock and roll band. But we, both Brian and I, wanted to concentrate on getting a publishing deal and a recording contract, and we were right in the middle of that time when Ultravox started to happen. You'd had Bowie had just done Heroes, had done Low. He was very influenced by Kraftwerk. Music on the radio was changing, and we were extremely oriented towards music that would get us a publishing deal and a recording contract. And even though our influences were possibly more American than possibly a lot of the English bands were, we believed in songs. We were influenced by the Doobie Brothers, the Tubes, and we just liked good songwriting as well. We couldn't help but fall in love with the idea of getting a Juno 60 into a room with a TIAC 4-track and making sounds. And, you know, to us, it represented Europe. You know, you had the American sound, blues and rock and roll.
Right.
But coming out of London at that time, and it really was the sound of Europe, you know. And you think about Germany was affecting a lot of artists because they were getting over the Holocaust, the war, and classical music had sort of stopped. And then suddenly Germany sort of pushed towards this atmosphere. And I think music at that time, we were right in the front of it. In the sense at the end of the 70s, the beginning of the 80s. Then, of course, as you mentioned, Mike, and I'll let Brian continue, the music became, you know, in the middle 85s and 86, synthesizers became used by a lot of the bands, which were pretty normal.
Right.
What brought me and Brian to America was that Dancing in Heaven, our first single, was played a lot on K-Rock and broke through as a very underground record with Wall of Voodoo
right.
doing Mexican radio and Devo doing Whip It. And so we the songs that we wrote together, Kim Carnes recorded, but they were written for Q-Feel. Mm-hmm. Magnetic was written for Earth, Wind & Fire was written for Q-Feel. Yeah, so we got all our cuts that time, and we moved into songwriting, but all our songs we put forward to the American artists were very European influenced. But a point that I think Brian could take on is that he came from a progressive
right.
guitarist, atmospheric kind of Jethro Tull Genesis,
right.
and I came from average white band kind of funk thing. Mm-hmm. Yet we both fell into going, these synthesizers and these sounds represent exactly where we are now, and it's happening now.
But you know, when you listen to the Q-Feel record...
you did? You're probably the same.
Thank you for doing that, Mike. I appreciate it.
No, but what's amazing is, you know, your influence, it sounds very progressive. It sounds very rock. I mean, the only one that sounds like... Dancing in Heaven is Dancing in Heaven, because you've got like you know, Heroes Never Die, and then and Crosstalk. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are not, they don't sound like, they're not a, you know, a dance song.
Well,
they have that influence of your progressive rock. Actually.
We were like kids in a sandbox when we got into the studio, because mm-hmm. when we started off, and we were like writing songs in your little flat in Islington in London. Yeah. We had no idea where we were going at first because we were like we were damping down bass strings for a kick drum like do 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 do, and we were like hitting our thighs for snares, and we were recording all this on single tracks and then overdubbing and overdubbing, and this is how we did all the demos. We had no money, we had no equipment, we had nothing. We had our mouths and our bass guitar and a guitar
and a Revo,
and so a Revo, and a Revo. That's what it was.
Yeah. It seemed like the late 70s, early 80s. And maybe I'm just naive, but seems also to be the era of tone. What used to be, you know, like you had the passion of the 60s.
Sound.
Yes. And you had disco in the 70s, which was what it was. But mm-hmm. all of a sudden it was, yeah, it was taking synths and sounds and textures and
oh, yeah.
and really it's not just the notes you play, but it's what you play them with and how you play them.
Yes. What we found liberating is what you're saying is you could write a song.
Musical sound design.
That was dark. You could write a romantic, I think they call it the romantic era. You could write a song like, you know, Friends Are Electric or Cars by yeah. Newman. And if you really think about it, and Vienna, Ultravox, a lot of these songs had, you were able to create a kind of European grimness. Yeah. And it's still, yet with its sounds and its attitude, be very commercial. Mm-hmm. And that, to us, was very attractive and extremely European because we lived in that place.
It was very universal. I mean, you know, like Ultravox. When you went to see Ultravox, the whole stage presence was grey. I mean, that was the
grey. Yeah.
Remember, they had their grey guitars. They had a grey cityscape behind them. It mm-hmm. was very Germanic.
Yes.
And then you had like, you know, obviously.
Bands you think like that's Berlin. The pushback from the disco where everything was happy and up? And,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, and there had to be a transition between punk and the new era of new age music or alternative music. And a lot of these bands did bridge that gap really well.
But, dead on, yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, obviously, you know, we all know punk was like this blockage of the 70s Zeppelin, you know, like go away.
Right.
Don't pay £150 for a ticket to go see a concert. Come and see us free. You know, so it was three guys plugging in live, and there was a lot of excitement to that. But it was short-lived. It's high energy and short-lived, and we had to pull from that and bridge that gap into the next thing. And we, you know, there was a lot of things going when we were writing. Remember, there was ska. We were
first single was like
the beat on the radio,
and that was Costello. Yeah,
but you know what's interesting when you look at 80s music, a lot of people identify like the second British Invasion, where you have like, you know, Flock of Seagulls mm-hmm. and those type of electronic
Thompson
bands
Twins.
And Thompson yep. Twins. But yep. but you know, it was such a small slice of the music scene. I mean,
it absolutely was.
1980, yeah. you know, you still had a lot of holdover from the disco era. KC and the Sunshine Band had number one hit. You also had country music coming up with, you know, the early 80s with like Robbie Dupree, you know, you had country, and then rock and roll, you know, you're
and
starting
even prog rock. I mean, yeah, you know, you Rob's favorite band, Rush.
Yeah,
yes.
You were starting to see.
I will
rock.
Just go on record. My least favorite band.
I didn't know what to do then, nod or not.
I'm on record.
But what's amazing is you always, when you think of 80s music, you always think of the electronic sound. But there was so much more happening during that time. Mm. I brought this up because this, to me, really one of the big differences that I think 1980 had between nowadays and even the 90s is people could play their instruments. You've got session musicians that were just monstrous, and mm-hmm. they would play on songs that you wouldn't even know. I'm going to give you some personnel that played on the song and see if you guys can guess. All right, on guitar was Steve Lukather. On electric
you
piano,
lose 5 points.
On electric piano was Michael McDonald. On acoustic grand piano was David Foster.
Oh.
On saxophone was David Sanborn.
Kenny Loggins.
Barbara Streisand.
On percussion was Lenny Castro.
Am I right?
Okay. Yep.
All right.
What was it?
I'm old.
Kenny Loggins.
Kenny Loggins. But, and that's an amazing sounding album.
Yeah, right. It is.
But,
yeah.
but that's just, I mean, those guys that was in, I'll tell you exactly when. That came
late
out
80s,
in
yeah.
1983.
Oh, really?
That's,
early.
That's when surprised. We came over. It's yeah. amazing. Yeah.
So, I mean, you had musicians that were absolutely. Playing. You had these session guys. Absolutely. And I think that one of the reasons why it separates a lot of that music is the fact that people we're still playing.
Well, when Martin and I came over to the States, our gateway into the States was through, you know, musicians like that. We got introduced to Earth, Wind & Fire, and we started working with you know, session musicians like, you know, Steve Lukather was
Abe Laboriel.
Abe Laboriel. Yeah.
John, and it was
Nathan
the
East.
Who was the drummer? We had the drummer that was playing with Rufus and played all
John Robinson.
Robinson.
J.R.
Exactly. Yeah, J.R. And, yeah, we had obviously all the White brothers, you know, like Freddie you know, and Maurice himself. But these were musicians that were, as far as we were concerned, way out of our league.
Yeah.
You know, we were like flies on the wall when we came over here. But that was our only way into American music and breaking America.
And what was fascinating is we'd go in there and all, and we'd put our little chord sheets up, and I said to Brian, they're going to take a few hours to get this. Bang! They hit
got it
like that straight away, and they'd listen to the demo, and Brian and I just stood back and were like, my God, you know. Yet, when we put our little Casio keyboard up and went donk, 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 they went, that's so cool, man.
They were asking us how we got that sound. You know, Martin's a bass player, and you know, we were being asked, how do you get that sound? And Martin would say, like, you know, to me, just bad playing.
You just don't have to play that well.
We got called in to do sessions, which scared us, scared us. I played keyboards on Teddy Pendergrass record. Ray Parker was producing it, and I was so terrified. And they said, what do you need? All the keyboards? Like Michael Boddicker? I said, well, just give me a Jupiter 8 and I'll fiddle about. And I was there.
Because we knew the Jupiter 8.
Yeah. And I was there with Bill Snay all day, just fiddling about with the knobs. And he was going, well, that's quite an interesting sound. And, you know, and it was just all our energy and our naive enthusiasm for atmosphere. And even we played on Ghostbusters, the first thing we played on, and it was Ray Parker saying, I like Yes's Owner from a Lonely Heart. He said, I like the sounds on that, and can you guys do that for us? So, again, it was the little keyboard and Brian playing some unusual guitar sounds through pedals, you know. So we came across and we printed sounds onto the tape. If we heard a good sound, we printed it, and we couldn't get used to, I think Brian remember this, the engineers printed everything clean, and then they said, we'll deal with it after. And we're going, no.
It was too
small.
That snare sound. Remember Kim Carnes? She used to call that, you know, that the snare, the trash snare.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when they recorded it, the American engineers recorded it, it sounded like, you know? And it was like, no, it is trash. It's supposed to be, you know, so when you
get
hit
the
that
AMS
snare,
on it, that was the sound.
Explode it. I mean, put some ambient mics out. You know, like, let's record the room as well as the initial impact of the snare, you know?
Hey, on Dancing with Heaven, the bass, what synth did you use for the bass?
We used a Moog on that, but our main keyboard was an Oberheim OB8. And we went into London ahead of time before we did the session, which was 16 tracks. Believe it or not.
Wow.
And there was a special keyboard guy. I've just been writing about this, and he was known for programming all the sounds for Queen. We went into, and he worked in a music shop, and he took us back to the, into a back room, and we had it all written down what we wanted. We said, this should sound like Angels. This should sound like Bomber Planes. And he just programmed everything for us. And of course, on the OB8, you write in your numbers. Right. And so I take notes that, like, Angels are 91 and 92. And we were methodical because we, in those days, we have one day in the studio and we hit that record in one day and one night. And it was just like one thing after another.
And a lot of the time it's downtime. I mean, we had to be out by 3 o'clock in the morning because somebody else was moving in and they were paying guests.
And so, it was the flock of seagulls that were always following us in because they were. But we got into trouble with it. This is not known, but we used to play around in the studio and they said a band called the Flock of Seagulls are coming in behind you. And we thought, a flock of seagulls.
What kind of name is that?
I mean, are they vets or something? You know?
Bucket of lemmings.
Well, we wrote on the wall, gaggle of lemmings. And we thought you couldn't ever get anything more bizarre than a gaggle of lemmings. Of course, we heard after that they saw it, and the engineers said they went
berserk.
Really? They were really serious.
No sense of humor.
So we had to be very careful about passing them in the
in the recording company.
That's hilarious.
That's awesome. You know, you touched, Brian touched on something we used to do with Stevie a lot in the 80s, which was miking the drum machines to try to create space.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember we used to set up these elaborate kits, like drum kits made out of speakers of all different kinds. And we would just be going through dozens and dozens of different kinds. Mm-hmm. And we'd set up like kits of speakers. Stevie's studio was huge and there was room to set up all these different things. We'd set up speakers in drum kit configurations and then mic the room as if we were miking a drummer.
Wow.
And then run the drum machines through those speakers. So like the, and I mean serious speakers, like do you remember the giant Meyer monitors?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Three or four feet tall. Yeah. The big, they were gray, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they weren't the wedges. They were studio monitors. They were gigantic. Oh, they were the size of refrigerators. So one of those would be a kick drum. And then we'd have another one pointing up at the ceiling, and that would be a snare. Mm-hmm. And then we'd have other speakers being the cymbals and other speakers being the toms. And these drum kits were huge because the speakers were much bigger than drums. And then we would mic the space and mic the room and mic the bathroom and mic the hallways and all this crazy stuff.
And mic.
And mic. We used to experiment. I mean, those were the days because working on those albums in the 80s, we would take a week to get a kick drum.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I kind of miss those different. Where you spent a lot of time trying to invent your sound.
Yes.
And experiment.
Oh, it was critical.
And it was great because now you get sound so easily, so quickly.
That's right.
You just kind of go, do I really want to spend that time to do that?
Well, you know what?
And you know.
Go back, Overjoyed, Stevie's song Overjoyed, which I think came out in 85. Yeah, because that's the year I joined him. I'm actually in the video for Overjoyed, which is
no kidding.
Or my left ear is anyway. But there's a piece
YouTube,
of trivia.
YouTube.
It's on Overjoyed. It's on there. I think I was wearing a sport jacket. Whatever. But Overjoyed, if you listen to that song, I mean, keep in mind that song was recorded probably in 83 or 84, if it came out in 85. And all of the drums on that song are sounds of nature. Mm. And they actually flew around the country and the world picking up these sounds. And like the kick drum of that song is dropping a giant boulder on the beach in Hawaii, I think it was. Mm. And they went around with a nagra and recorded all these sounds. And the percussion is all birds and crickets. And it's all sounds of nature. And the snare or the side stick is a water droplet. And you have to realize this is 1983. Now, that would take you 5 seconds to do. It's the easiest thing in the world.
Or just get Diego to do it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But what an interesting thing. I mean, it comes down to real simplicity that in the 60s and the 70s, although everybody experimented, and in the 80s, it really came down a great deal to sound texture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the technology grew enough that you could do these things. I mean, in those early, early sampling days, what Stevie used was a customized sampling system where you could basically record your sounds into a computer and edit your samples. It wasn't waveforms. You could see hexadecimal numbers on the screen, and you could edit your samples numerically. And then when you wanted to trigger the sound, this giant computer had a ribbon cable that went to a little chip that you would then plug into a Lindrum.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then so you would sample your sound with this computer, edit it in hex, and then basically print it to a chip.
Yeah.
And then you could trigger it from within the Lindrum machine, and it would replace the factory sound of the Lindrum machine. And so when you hear a song like Overjoyed, you have to realize those guys spent forever doing that.
That was the art.
It was, and
recording.
It was art.
Yeah.
I mean, that was what inspired me to go into sound design.
Yes.
I mean, mm-hmm. I loved the prog rock bands. And when I hear the tones, it was great to hear, you know, a normal sound and a good melody.
Right.
But all of a sudden, whether it was Genesis or Yes or any of the bands, you go, what's that? And how did they do that?
Absolutely.
Pink Floyd.
What made those sounds? And how do I do that? You know. And
well, we were speaking into vacuum cleaners.
Yeah.
We were
Heroes Never Die has Brian doing a pilot.
We started off with we actually hired a World War II pilot's mask because we were doing the pilot talk, you know, like the bandits 3 o'clock, all this kind of stuff, and it didn't sound right with the mask. So, yeah, we threw around a whole bunch of stuff. We ended up, like, speaking down the tube of a vacuum cleaner. Mm-hmm. And that was perfect, you know? And it was just so experimental, and it was like taking real photographs as opposed to digital imaging these days. I mean, your digital imaging is two-dimensional compared to the actual taking of a photograph back in the day.
You went into the studio.
You had to set your f-stop and all this kind of stuff.
Thinking about sound. I mean, you talked to your engineer for a great period of time saying the atmosphere of this. You know, and you can look at bands like The Fix and Red Skies and the tracks they were doing at that time. It was you went into the studio with a good song, maybe, you know, even what you thought was a hit song, but one of your main things was that you had to create colours.
Right.
Which, really through the 70s, it was a lot to do with feel and just good songs, and black music was really rolling that way. But with the Europeans I think, being honest, you know, we thought, no, we don't really sing as well. We don't play as well as some of the Americans do. But our own nature of vibe and taking the European influence is going to be really, really unique. Yeah. It gave us a sense of strength, even when we worked with, as Brian said, musicians which knocked us out.
Right.
We knew that they looked upon us as though these guys are bringing something else to the party.
I think one thing about the 80s is when you look back, the fact that it was kind of the perfect storm between this focus on sound and then technology kind of growing along the same way. Because back in the day, back in the 80s, it was really exciting to see the music tech evolve into affordable tech. Because that was really the first time people could start buying their own affordable effects and reverbs and things like that.
Yes, it was.
And I think the first one that really kind of lit my fire was the MIDIverb. You know, it was 12-bit reverb, but it was digital reverb.
I still
reverb.
Got two of them. You know?
And that, I think that lit a lot of people's fire, because that it was this reverb before then was like spring reverb, or it was, you know,
it was the WEM copycat with the four or the five heads with the loop of tape.
It was just effects themselves, just digital effects and delays and things like that. It was very mysterious, especially if you were just your own little musician trying
That's
to work
on. That's a good word,
on.
Mysterious.
But even the concept of samplers, you had Fairlight, you had Sinclair popping up.
But those were still way expensive. I'm talking about getting down to
You went down to later and EMU. Became the EMUs.
Well,
absolutely.
But even EMUs, that was really expensive too. I'm talking about, how about the Casio SK1, which was a lot of people's first.
The Akaya 612.
I mean, those were
And the SPX90 was like the little cheap reverb. Different sounds in it, didn't it?
And another one was the Roland, the S10. You know, that had the quick disc. Didn't even have a disc drive.
Well, the biggest one is the 80s, the creation of MIDI. The creation of MIDI.
Well, yeah.
That was everything. That's where it started.
That's the thing. That was... It was really exciting. I mean, I feel really fortunate to have grown up during that time. I just remember going in and hearing like the JP80. I don't know if you guys remember that keyboard. The first time I heard warm strings on that and the headphones, I was at a Coast Music. I'll never forget. It was down in South Orange County. And you just play that chord. And it was like this sound that you've never heard before, you just wanted to live in it. Yes, it was warm. It would just wrap you up and just kind of like saying,
What about the Polymoog and sequential circuits?
Yeah. We used to hear sounds like that, but we didn't know how to get them.
Right.
You know, we couldn't afford sequencers. MIDI was new when we first started doing the Q-Fuel, so a lot of our sequencing wasn't sequencing. A lot of it was digital delay.
Right.
And it was time delay. If it was 120 beats per minute, we timed a delay to that.
Right.
You know? So you play one note and it doubles itself, and that's how we did Dancing in the Heaven. That was digital delay.
Which is, you know, that brings up another thing, is a lot of the techniques that we take for granted nowadays, you know, were invented back then. Yeah. Like running a drum beat into a keyboard, into a gate, and getting that rhythmic effect and all that kind of stuff. Yes. I mean, it was really cool to hear new sounds and to hear new production techniques. But also, it was the start of the affordable music. I mean, things were getting affordable.
Really hard time on bands that when we came into LA, but people like, you know, Jackson Brown, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joni Mitchell. It was a really, really hard for them to get to grips with this. And same with Earth, Wind & Fire, with me and Brian working with them. They had to move forward. They had to try it. But it wasn't natural to them. You know, you look back on their best albums, much much better in the past when they were doing what they did best. But you could see that they had no choice, that you had all these record companies saying, we need you to move in if you're going to compete. Yeah. But some of these artists absolutely were not in line with it.
You're so right, because they were the record companies back then.
Bad records were made.
You could really see how powerful they were because they gave a lot of bad advice to a lot of really great artists. I mean, they made them do stuff that was just horrible.
It was the era of the executive producer who was an A&R person who used to sit at the back and say, you know something, I think that it needs a little bit more treble and you need to pull this back, you make this louder. In fact, make everything louder than everything else and it'll be great, you know. So that's what we did. We just push it up and say, how does that sound? And they'd say, it's great. We never touched anything. Yeah. So, I mean, that was the attitude that we had in the studio at that time. It was
I'm sure it's the same, but A&R men were saying, listen to the DuPage Road record, listen to this, listen to that. And Brian and I got involved with producing a lot of American acts at that time, but they weren't really, you know, it was like they were being forced to do something which wasn't natural.
There's destructive technology. It seems like every 10 to 13 years, there's always disruptive music.
Yes.
Because what happens is in the first half, everyone goes, it's new, it's exciting, it's fresh, this is really fun. Then I think businesses capitalize on it for the second 5 years, commercialize it, and will feed you as much as you'll eat.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with disco.
So it's coming out your ears.
And the same thing with the 80s, then what happens with grunge and said, okay, you know what, we're tired of overly produced to the point where there's no soul, and it went the other way.
Well, and the thing about the 80s, too, is you had people who didn't understand the technology and didn't understand, you know, some of the things that could be done because you were being force-fed all this dancey pop stuff, which was, you know.
As you were saying to me, Mike, there were some brilliant records, but some absolutely dire records were made then
as well.
Yeah,
there's just horrible ones. But there was also really good bands out there. I always point to these guys because they're one of my favorite bands of all time, which is Wang Chung. I mean, you listen to early Wang Chung, stuff before Points of a Curve. It was soulful and it was
when they were Hung Chung
because they originated the concept.
Yeah.
It wasn't a copy of somebody else's,
right? And it wasn't you know everybody Wang Chung tonight. I mean, there's some really good stuff and. You know, there's a lot of bands that were like that. I mean,
Tears for Fears came out and did some great stuff.
Tears for Fears is another one. Yeah. They're
and those albums, I mean, listen to Tears for Fears. Actually, listen to Everybody Wang Chung tonight. There was plenty of music from the 80s that we made fun of at the time. Listen to it now and realize how unbelievable the production level was. Because the bar was so much higher.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, those records still sound really, really amazing.
Fantastic.
Dance All Day is amazing.
So,
but you know the funny thing is when we're talking about the transition we made when we came into Earth, Wind & Fire wanted to be simplified, and we came in with these giants of music, and we had this kind of feeling. Remember that weird feeling that we had to give them what they want, but we wanted to get something from them at the same time.
Yeah. You know, because we wanted to hear the horns.
Before we came over to America, we saw Earth, Wind & Fire at Wembley Stadium. Remember that?
We were
right in the front row, and we thought, oh my God, it took the skin off her face. It was fantastic.
That was the Phoenix Horn section, right? I saw them down there at White Meadows, and let me just tell you, that was – there's nothing like – no synth can do that. A lot of horn section.
But he would not put horns on this record. That was his movement towards the future.
We were so intent on learning their tricks. You know, how'd you get that sped up horn sound? And he said, it's easy. You just turn the tape to half speed, and you go, and then you speed it back up again.
How'd they do that live, though, you know?
And they were like, never mind all that. How'd you get that snare sound? The one that you throw into the room, and you put a noise gate on, and it's severe, and it goes, that sound. That's what they wanted, you know?
You know, we're looking back, and this is really great, looking at back at the 80s, but You flash forward to where we are today, and a lot of the same things could be happening, especially with electronic music and stuff. But what's really interesting is you see how the 80s influence is really still there, and it's really just always kind of behind. And I think a lot of the like circuit bending and a lot of those type of minimalist synths that you see out there are just people, you know, kind of going back to the throwback days of
synthesizers always sound modern. You know, when you look back right to the beginning, which you could say in England in the end of the 50s was like the Doctor Who theme, and you know, by the BBC Radiophonic Shop, and then you look at Telstar, you know, by Joe Meek. It all it sounds modern now, and if you listen to anybody from Lady Gaga to Arcade Fire,
right.
You're going to go, this sounds contemporary, because synthesizers and electricity still sounds like it's on the front line.
You know, you are so correct in that. I was listening, I drove out to Texas.
And in fact, Radiohead sound like Can. No, really.
It's true.
That's they
right.
sound like oh. Can.
I was driving out to Texas, and I had a little XM radio, and I was listening to Radio Classics, and that's the station that plays all the dramas and the from the 40s and from the 30s and all those radio shows. And there was this one, I think it was something X, like X Factor or I don't know. But they were it was a space. They were doing this space show, and all the effects were like, woo, woo, and all the
oscillators
and all that. Mm. It sounded like a Moog. I mean, but this was done in like the 40s, you know, years before.
Tape editing.
And it was just like, and it was amazing. I also listened to this one program called Behind the Mic, and they did a sound effect of the week, and they play a sound effect, and then they'd have the sound designer tell how he did the sound effect. And like this one sound effect was a ocean liner going through ice, cutting through ice out in the ocean. And it was amazing because the guy would said, well, we get this and this piece of, you know, I forgot what they had. It was like, you know, like a metal plate and some scraping and something like that. They would record them on a vinyl record and then they'd play it half speed. And then they'd re-record that along with the other vinyl records.
Oh, yeah.
And then they would play that at half speed, and they'd kind of comp them all together. But it was just – even back then, it's just amazing how all of – you know, everybody's in search of the sound. And like you said, electronic music, those little beeps, those little synthesizers, that it always sounds contemporary. It always sounds like –
You guys even said it, and even going back that far, it almost seems like when there's no pressure and you got nothing to lose and you got time to experiment, that's really where I think some of the magic – I think in those days – The Foley sound effects guy
absolutely
was somebody like,
absolutely
who wants to do this? Yeah. You're going to do it. You know, okay, I'll figure it out.
And there's no right way to do it. I feel that's where I am now. I mean, if I were put in a studio now, that's where I am. There's no pressure anymore. I'm not 18 years old. You know, it's like, you know, there's no record company saying, get the record out at the end of the month. You know, it cares.
Even when I do movies and I'll hear a sound effect from the cutting room, the, you know, visual effects guys, and they're like, they're not sound guys. So the guy goes, you know, I had a little recorder and I did this thing, and it was like no big deal. And I went, that's really kind of cool, actually.
Yeah.
Because again, there's no pressure. It's not what they do. And I think that the art of discovery is something that we got to keep reminding ourselves as professionals. And even for those people that aren't in the business or trying to get in the business, or starting the business, there's a certain passion. There's a, you know, your house is full with so many things that could be used musically or sound design that it's endless only if you have the imagination.
We're going to have to wrap this up, but Rob, did
you want to say I was going to actually sort of semi-wrap it up by saying, you know, the 80s weren't entirely golden.
Right.
And I think I can sum up in one word what I don't miss about the 80s, because we're talking about all these amazing, you know, Synclavs and Fairlights and all this high-end gear that I was lucky enough to get to play with, and a lot of engineers did. And then there were all kinds of, you know, the SBX-80 sync boxes from Roland and
the
all these different things.
Floppies.
The thing I don't miss from the 80s is synchronization.
Yeah.
Trying to get these toys to play together was more than half the time.
Yeah. That's true.
It was unbelievable how much time you'd waste.
J.O. Cooper boxes on every, you know.
Yeah.
How about tuning oscillators on old synths?
That was all, I guess.
Memory mode. Like, is it a tuner or not?
And what was
Simpty
it?
Simpty and
sync track.
Doctor, the pulse tone and the pilot tones.
Pilot tones.
Doctor Click.
We used to save our sounds on a Jupiter 8 to a cassette.
That's right.
That's how we saved
our
sounds.
I still have a bunch of those.
And tuning is random.
That's right.
It's optional.
But to, you know, to put this full circle, I'm over at Martin's house this past weekend, and we're setting up synths, and it's all being, we're doing MIDI, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of best of both worlds. It was great to be back in that MIDI mode because I really know that really well.
MIDI's old now, though.
But I had to – we're having some problems because the Pro Tools buffer was just getting overloaded, and we couldn't figure out why is this buffer getting overloaded. So I went over and I used my iPad. I got a little – you know, the little IK Multimedia MIDI I.O., mm-hmm. hooked it up, had MIDI monitor software, and it was – I wish I had this on the road because I used to have the old Studio Master MIDI monitor.
Oh, yeah. I still
have
one.
Now you can do it on your iPad, and it just tells you all the information. You can see all the channels that we're sending out. You can see the notes. You can see the velocity. You can see – I mean, everything was coming across.
Yeah, and an iPad in 1983 would have been real handy.
It was just so great.
Of course, there was no App Store.
Yeah, but it was so great to see just both the technologies, the little bit of the old and the new, mm-hmm. just working together. And once
hey,
we
Mike,
solved
why,
it –
why didn't we have that during that gig in Indiana where everything like crashed?
Was it Cincinnati,
right. Yeah, we were halfway through a song and suddenly everything just stopped.
I know.
But if he pulled his iPad out, he'd he's from another world.
I remember when the floppies went smaller. They were like 10-inch, then they went 7-inch, and then they went 5-inch.
And you're like 3 1/4.
3 1/4,
right. 5 1/4 to 3 1/2.
All right, before we go, we're gonna have to edit this down for one thing.
Well, luckily... this isn't the 80s, and we can actually do
it
in Pro Tools.
That's right. But I just have to ask everybody this one quick question and then keep the answers short. But Rob, what was your favorite 1980s memory with technology and music?
With technology and music, actually, my favorite 1980s memory when it comes to technology is I had just joined Stevie, and his other programmer had – his previous programmer had just left, and this is before I created the music software for the blind and all the stuff I was doing with him a little bit later on. But when I first started with him, he basically put me in a room at his studio, and he didn't really even know me that well, but there was a Synclavier in there, and it was this giant monolith of a machine. And he said, I need you to figure out how to use that thing. We're cutting a song in a couple days, and the manual's around here someplace.
Wow.
And I found the manual. The manual was like 10 feet wide on a whole bookshelf, and I didn't even go home for like a whole week. I was 22, so I had a good attitude back then. But I just stayed up round the clock learning to use this thing. And I realized this is not only a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity because it's for Stevie, who was my hero at the time.
Right.
But just to learn a Synclavier, which is something I'd only heard about in sort of folklore.
Wow.
So that's definitely my favorite.
Brian.
Mine's a lot simpler. It was feeling so, so special because I was the only one that could program the second-generation Lindrum in the whole studio. And Maurice White, like, relied on me for doing it. And the number of gigs I worked with Chaka Khan because I could do this, you know, it was ridiculous. Remember that? It was ridiculous.
You know? That's awesome.
I just got around because of this, you know, and I felt, like, really guilty about it because it was like, this isn't difficult.
Fabio.
You know, it was a blur to me.
That means you had a good time.
That's right.
No, quite the opposite. I didn't. And there's so many things. There are more negative things than positive things that I can think of.
Wow.
Technology-wise. So I'd rather not even go there.
Mm. Wow, that's a whole other podcast. The dark side of the 80s.
The dark side of the moon.
You know, for me, I think that... goodness. You know, to show the range for me, I mean, I started college.
Okay, I said short.
In the early 80s. No, it's funny. I started college in the early 80s on non-MIDI gear, went to MIDI, and I ended the 80s on a waveframe. Mm-hmm. And to show you the range between using Moog modulars and ARPs and Buglas and stuff like that. To all then when I went to Synclavier, everybody was like, no, it's aliasing, it doesn't sound organic, I would never use it, it's not right enough. Then all these friends got together, created a company, created Waveframe, and I remembered showing the film, because I was one of the first guys to use a Waveframe in film, taking a little pulley sound, slowing it down, adding reverb, and I had whales. Mm. And it was the sampler, nobody could do that. It was so great. And that whole span of time in the 80s for me kind of defined what I was going to do for the next 20 years, 30 years.
Mike, I thought of something actually. The time I spent with Frank Zappa in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Just to make it really simple, that was great and it was precious and, you know, nothing like
that. That's awesome. That would be awesome.
That's a good one. You had us really depressed there for a second. So
I know.
That's good.
Martin.
Yeah, you know, I think it was just because Brian and I arrived at a very special time for us. You know, we were very, very fortunate to come into a town in LA where all the doors were open to us. Our heroes wanted to work with us. We were a great partnership. We were best friends. And so it was full of a magical time. You know, we were moving between Earth, Wind & Fire, Kim Carnes, Commodores, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire, everybody. And it was a great apprenticeship for us. And particularly for me, it just sort of taught me a great deal. And, you know, there's so many memories of that time. Mainly for me was it was lovely to be two guys together which had come through the London scene and were buddies. And suddenly we were in paradise in Los Angeles with meeting everybody. Everybody wanted to open their doors to us. And we got to produce a really good band called Bone Symphony for Capitol Records, doing an album called It's Jungle Out There. And it did really well in Europe. And so it was just a very, very, very fresh, right time to come. And we didn't have any rest, and yet we were totally...
Didn't notice
because it was the right time. Some things in your life, you write the right songs, you produce the right songs, you're in form, just like a sportsman. That's what it was for us then, you know. And in fact, not to make it, you know, anything more than that, I think the song Dancing in Heaven that we did together in London, we knew was built for America. Mm. We actually recorded it thinking this is Parliament meets the Tubes meets Tom Dolby. And we aimed ourselves that way, and the record proved itself to be our ticket over. So the time we came over, the first couple of years were just bliss.
What year did you actually come over?
I think we came...
1983, February 1983.
Yeah, I think Brian's right there. And, of course, we came into town and Dancing in Heaven was on LA radio constantly. We just couldn't believe it. You know, we went to hire a wreck car. You know, they used to be able to hire wrecks in those times.
Rent-a-wreck. Yeah. Remember that?
Yeah. And all we did, that was we'd say, what's the radio like? And so there's no tires on this. The radio works. And, you know, we were interviewed on K-Rock. And still to this day, K-Rock still says we're in the top, like, 75 of their all-time songs in their history. So it was, you know, you for us, who were really behind-the-scenes guys, you know, we didn't see ourselves as, you know, the Beatles or anything like that. We just saw ourselves as constructors of songs.
Right.
We sort of came into a period of 2 years in L.A. where we were up the front.
It was magical.
It really was the golden era of the record industry,
really
wasn't
was.
It?
We would come home to a place we were staying, Diane's house, when we both first met, and we would turn on the answer phone, and literally we'd have 70 to 80 calls from every record company in the country wanting to meet us.
For lunch.
Yeah. Wow.
That's fantastic.
And, of course, a lot of lunches.
Yeah. It is. And so we had a lot of... The key was, I think Brian agreed to this, we had a lot of fun. Yeah. Didn't we, Brian? We laughed a lot.
Well, that kind of beats my favorite memory.
What's yours? What's yours? Go on, Mike.
Actually, I'll never forget, by far the best memory that I have, because it kind of started everything, was I was at Goodman's Music in Anaheim, and it's the first time I played an OBXA with the DMX drum machine, and you could sync them together, and this was pre-MIDI. It wasn't even MIDI. Mm, they used their own, and I'll never forget having a little sequence, the little arpeggiator on the OBXA in sync with the drum machine, the DMX, and being able to program that just as a demo, because I couldn't afford either one of those. The drum machine was like $1,500 and the synth was like $3,000. Mm-hmm. But I remember playing it and I got it. I knew it was very like I could understand it. And that's when I kind of had a little inclination that I was kind of good at this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that really, that moment where it all kind of clicked just fed my whole desire to learn more and to
inspiration.
Exactly. Yeah. It was that little moment, you know, and that, you know, the 80s were just a great time. It really, well, for some of us, but, and I just think, you know, to wrap this up, you can just, I think nowadays we take for granted so many things that we have around us in our production with our Pro Tools and our and our synths and just the sounds. And I mean, I got this little Korg micro synth station. It's not even a full size keys. It's 5 octaves. And I was playing the sounds in that, and the sounds are phenomenal. And then you can download the editor and create your own sounds. And it's just amazing how we can get sounds so easy nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Also, you know? At that time, and I'm going on, but in the 80s, we were, you do think about putting a lot of different things together. Yeah. You know, you would have your normal rhythm section, but you would have a drum machine and a drummer, and you would have synthesizers, and you may have a horn section. So it really was a time when, past the 70s, everything sort of opened up into a conglomeration of experimentation.
You can see its influence in not only in songwriting and songs, but in production and, and technology. And it was just a wonderful time. And I think nowadays you get people that are looking back at that time and kind of wanting to grab some of that same type of magic.
I've got a Jupiter 8 in my house, and anybody who hasn't seen one comes across and goes, oh my God, it's like from Jerusalem. It's a spiritual thing.
Really quick, Jeremy, what was your favorite 1980s?
Being born.
I got 40!
Actually, can I follow up that story really fast? I went over to Bobby's Bobby Summerfield's house, and he has racks, just like Rob and probably everybody in the room does, of synthesizers, and they were all of those synths that y'all have been talking about the whole time, and I just went, ugh, because I've never seen any of them before. Wow. And it was the coolest thing. So I had the same reaction that people walk into your place and have. So. Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, Brian, thanks for joining us,
hey,
man.
Thanks for having me.
Brian.
Very unexpected. I should have made my own speech now.
No, it was fantastic. Brian, I met Brian when I was working with Martin in the 90s, and we toured the world together and
had
a great time. And
That was a sweet time to go out.
It really was.
It was fantastic. It was. I'll tell you, that was the best tour
I
ever did.
Why didn't I mention that as my highlight? That was a great time.
It was a great tour.
But it wasn't the 80s.
That was the 90s.
It was the 90s.
That was
That's the next show. We'll do the 90s. Whole different show.
That's the next show.
That's the 90s show that we're
Which
doing.
Means we have two more show ideas. We're totally set.
So great.
That was great.
No, but that was good. Relationships, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Anyhow, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And before we go, anybody working on anything that they want to talk about?
It's absolutely nothing going on.
I know. Back in the '80s, we were employed.
Yeah, that's right. The '80s, totally.
Yeah,
story.
I was really prolific in the '80s.
Honestly, we've been talking so long tonight, I forget what I'm working on.
Actually, Mike, I'm building a studio with you, which is full of synthesizers.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
right.
What I'm developing, and Mike is helping me make two rooms totally open to synthesizers and free creativity. Because you never know what's going to come out of that. Electric experimentation. You never know. That's the good things.
All right. Well, once again, if you have any... Oh, you know what? We got to... Let's plug your album, too.
Oh, yeah. I just did an album, didn't I?
So many of them, you know. Yes, another one.
Yeah, it's doing very well, Mike, and I want to thank all the people that supported it early on, and it's had a really nice launch and doing very steady at independent outlets, so I'm very, very, very pleased.
Tell everybody the title of it once again.
It's called A Temper of Peace. And it's out now on CD Baby and iTunes and everywhere else, it seems, that once a record gets out, everybody sells it. But, yeah, it's getting a nice response, and it's just very encouraging.
I also want to encourage people, if you get a chance, go on YouTube and look for some of the other music by Q-Field. Because there's some really good stuff out there.
How do you spell Q-Field?
Sorry?
It's Q-F-E-E-L.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's not – I just want to tell you right off the bat, it's not like Dancing in Heaven. Mm-hmm. That track was its own thing. And
it was.
It's really good. It's just – you can really see all the influence that we were talking about. All right. Well, that was a long show.
I was going to say, we can't possibly be done.
Yeah, I know. All right. Well
– put a fork in this one, Mike.
Let's one more time. No.
No.
Just kidding.
Let's not.
All right. Well, for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.